potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films, The Marvels, The Holdovers, Journey to Bethlehem, It's a Wonderful Knife, and Bloody Bridget. I'm also going to be talking about some news, The Trailer Park, and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Insidious, The Red Door. But first, how can you get in touch with me? Well, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Blue Sky or Mastodon, I'm at Kevin Carr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The strike's over, everybody. The other strike's over. I mean, of course, the writer's strike was over several weeks ago, but the actor strike is finally over, tentatively. There's a tentative deal agreed to. It still has to be released to the members and voted on by the members. I think they have a couple days to go through all of that, and then they have to going to have to ratify it. But right now, picketing is done. They are no longer striking against the studios, and work can resume on all these other films like Venom 3 and Beetlejuice and all those productions that were put on hold. And, now IATSE in a couple months, they may be striking too. So we'll see what happens there. And those people, they'll shut a production down because they're the people who basically move all the crap around. But right now, you got the actors happy. The directors wrote a deal a while ago. They didn't do anything for this, really. And then the actors held out as long as the writers did. Maybe not as long, but they didn't have as long of a strike. But their strikes overlapped, and it basically shut the industry down for 6 months. From what we understand, it includes increases in minimum rates, and it has a streaming bonus participation. I don't know exactly how that works out. Health and pension caps and diversity guardrails. But the big thing, this was the big thing for the actors. It wasn't as big for the writers. The writers was more about time in the writer's room and number of staffing and that sort of thing. The thing that really was a sticking point for actors was the AI protections. They didn't want the studios just scanning whoever they wanted to and then being able to use their scans forever, which was kind of the plan. And there's a certain amount of insidiousness to that, because when you've got extras, they're going to sign whatever form you want. They're not lawyered up. These are people who are making studio minimums, and they're just trying to break in the industry, and they take advantage of them by getting them to sign whatever they can. And I had heard stories about these extras going into the films and then just getting their whole body scanned, and that's owned by the studio. Well, they're putting up protections for that. We don't know the exact details, but as I've been reading, it's that they can't use your scan without A, getting your permission, and B, compensating you for a future use of your scan. And that's important. It's also important because, as I understand it, those protections, the actors wanted to have something that went beyond their life, so that when you die, if they have your scan, they have to pay your estate for the right to use your image, just as somebody would have to pay to use elements of somebody's life. If you can't just go and use any footage from some actor who's dead and not pay them for that. You have to pay the right people who own that image, which is your own likeness. So these things are going to be very difficult. And apparently they're on the negotiating table and being worked through from day one all the way to day 118. And these are important. Now, a lot of people have kind of rolled their eyes and been like, have you seen CGI created images? They look like garbage. They look like garbage now. But throw a good 10, 20 years of technology on that, and they may not. The ability to manipulate digital imagery is not about what can be done now, but it's about what can be done in the future with that source code. And the actors were just protecting their source code, and good for them. But it's good that it's also done, and now they can kind of wrap up what they need to do for award season and promote stuff, and they can start the productions full force in January when everything returns from the holidays. Let's hit the box office real quick, too. Five Nights at Freddy's kept the top spot on the weekend. It dropped huge. It dropped 76%, which is a massive drop, but that's expected for a horror film, but it's come in at like 113 million total at the end of last weekend. It's more now because you had the midweek showings, but it was over 113 million at the end of last weekend. This is a horror movie that cost, what, like $20, $25 million to make. This is a massive hit. This is a massive cash cow, and this is what Blumhouse does best. It's create movies you can do on the cheap, and then you can get, you know, even 113 million is, that's what killed The Flash, but it's going to make Five Nights at Freddy's a franchise. Priscilla did not hit the big numbers. I don't think anyone was expecting it. It made about $5 million, ended up at number 4 after Taylor Swift and Killers of the Flower Moon. And you know, there's a bunch of think pieces out there being written about how Killers of the Flower Moon is flopping. Look, Apple wasn't originally even going to release this into wide release in theaters. So at the right now, they're over $52 million in the States and whatever it is, you know, for the full worldwide numbers. But Killers of the Flower Moon, that's 52 million or 100 million when you take in international numbers that they didn't have on it. Apple was just going to drop this on their streaming service, so it's not a big deal for them. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is The Fall Guy, starring Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt, coming to theaters on March 1st.
Tom Ryder, the biggest action star on the planet, is missing. You need to bring him back, or Jodie's movie is dead.
Why me?
You're a stuntman. Nobody's going to notice you. That's your job. No offense.
I mean, some taking.
You find Ryder, save Jodie's film. You get the love of your life back.
I'm not the hero. I'm just the double.
Not today, you're not.
I don't know quite what to think about this movie, because I remember watching the Fall Guy TV show with Lee Majors as a kid. And even, I think, about 15 years ago, I got the DVD set to review, or at least one of the seasons. And the Fall Guy was one of those. There were a bunch of these shows made in the 80s. And some in the 70s, about somebody who just sort of helped people out from time to time. Poker Face, that show with Natasha Lyonne on Peacock, that's a throwback to those kind of shows of somebody wanders around and just helps different people. Burn Notice was another somewhat recent show that had that premise. But I mean, it had everything from BJ and the Bear to The Master to... The Fall Guy was a great example of that. Even though he was in LA because he was a stuntman, he just basically picked up odd jobs and helped people out. This looks like it's trying to be some big gangster extravaganza. Maybe it's going to do what 21 Jump Street did for the franchise, which sort of was inspired by it, but kind of took it to a silly level. Maybe that's what's going on here, but I kind of would like to see an authentic, good old fashioned Fall Guy rather than it just looks like it's going to be overblown. The next one I want to hit really quickly is Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, which is coming to theaters on March 29th.
People froze to death in the middle of July.
What is it?
The death chill. The power to kill by fear itself. Your veins turn to rivers of ice. Your bones crack. And the last thing you see... your own tear ducts freezing up.
Like, literally scared to death?
So cool.
This looks interesting because it looks like there's a real threat. And they've brought back Dan Aykroyd and also Bill Murray's in the trailer. He doesn't say anything. You can hear Dan Aykroyd's voice in the trailer there. But Bill Murray, you just see his face. But I liked Ghostbusters Afterlife. I like kind of what they did. I liked how they... that they tied it together to the original series. And this looks like they might be doing some pretty crazy stuff. It looks like Paul Rudd's having fun. That's good, isn't it, I guess? I don't know. This one I'm looking forward to. It's a March movie. I'm looking forward to this one more than I am The Fall Guy, that's for sure. Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about The Holdovers and It's a Wonderful Knife. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews and talk about The Holdovers. It's Alexander Payne's latest movie. Paul Giamatti stars as an acerbic teacher at a private academy in the 1980s who must manage the students who didn't go home for Christmas break.
I heard you got stuck with babysitting duty this year. How'd you manage that?
You know, he used to be a student, right?
Yeah, that's why he knows how to inflict maximum pain on us.
I thought all the Nazis were hiding in Argentina.
Stifle it, Tully.
You just earned yourself a detention, sir.
Being here with you is already one big detention.
That's another detention.
Do you think I want to be babysitting you? No, I was praying your mother would pick up the phone or your father would arrive in a helicopter or a flying saucer.
My father's dead.
I appreciate Alexander Payne's work, but I'm not a huge fan. There's a lot of critics out there who Alexander Payne can just, like, do no wrong. And I don't necessarily think that. Well, he's a talented director, sure. And he's done some decent stuff, but I've never loved his stuff. I've loved elements of it. I've loved Paul Giamatti in the stuff he's done. And Sideways, he did Sideways. That's a great example of a movie that I didn't love, other people did, but I totally agreed that Paul Giamatti was brilliant in it. Part of the reason I didn't like Sideways is because I have heard too many people go, I don't like romantic comedies. Oh, Sideways! I like Sideways! Sideways is not a romantic comedy. I mean, there's a romance in it, and it's a romantic comedy for people who hate themselves. But it's not a romantic comedy when you think of, like, Julia Roberts and Sandra Bullock and Reese Witherspoon movies from the 90s and the 2000s. I guess it fits in it, but it's certainly not something that's going to go well in a romantic comedy setting. It's not a light romance. And The Holdovers, a lot of people say, oh, it's a great comedy. It is. It's a comedic thing. It's a very darkly comedic movie. But I would be reticent to call this one a comedy. It's a drama. In my opinion, it's a drama. There's some very funny stuff in it, and Paul Giamatti is at the epicenter of all of that. But in a comedy, you're sort of laughing with the people, even when somebody's the butt of the jokes. Like I talked about Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein a couple weeks ago. That's totally a comedy because, I mean, even though you're laughing at Lou Costello bumbling around, you're laughing with him because he's in on the joke. But something like The Holdovers isn't as much a comedy because you're more laughing at what the people do. You're laughing at their dysfunction and they don't seem in on the joke. And that's, I think, the difference. I mean, it's still entertaining. I think it has some very clever stuff to it, but there is something about independent art house award type films that are very heavy and seem to be made by people who hate themselves. And I've never met Alexander Payne. I don't know what he's like as a person, but especially this movie, even more than something like Sideways, these kind of movies, they're people who struggle with their own dysfunction, and there's a reality to it. But sometimes, here's the thing, I don't necessarily need to see a movie about reality. I like to see a movie about interesting characters, and I like to see a movie that has reality in it, a real or characters cut from reality. But if I want to see reality, I'll just walk outside. If I want to see people in depressing situations that I can laugh at them, well, I'll just walk down the street. So I don't think this is a work of genius. I do think Paul Giamatti's really good in it. And his acting is very, very good. It does dredge up some very familiar territory. I'm not necessarily saying that I've seen this exact movie before, but these elements, because the kid he's watching has issues with his family and he acts out in a personal way. I think the real growth potential here is Paul Giamatti's character. I think he's the one who changes the most. I think he's the one who owns the movie, whereas it really feels like it's the kid's movie, even though Paul Giamatti is just better at grabbing hold of that all. So, I mean, it works for a degree, to a degree. I mean, it's fine. It's good. It's good. I just don't think it's brilliant. But it is a darkly humorous character study into self-isolation and self-destruction that presents the warmth of dysfunction. I mean, there's a tenderness about the dysfunction here, which there's a certain amount of reality in that, and that's okay. I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next one I want to talk about is It's a Wonderful Knife, obviously a play on a Christmas movie. This is on Shudder, the streaming service for horror and thrillers. A teen who survived a serial killer wishes she'd never been born, only to discover the world becomes much, much worse with the serial killer still alive.
Last Christmas still haunts me.
Time to let that go.
No one cares. I stood under the aurora and said everyone would be better off if I never existed. Well, wish granted. No one in this town knows me.
Who are you?
Dad. You weren't around to stop him, so he just kept going. He likes killing.
I'm here now.
Let's have some fun.
We've had several of these kind of movies where they take a horror film and they give a different spin to it. They either play it off of a science fiction kind of movie or sort of mixed the genres. We saw that the big one, obviously, Happy Death Day, where you put a time loop into a slasher film, or something like Totally Killer. I just talked about a couple weeks ago. That's basically a slasher film, only you throw in a Back to the Future storyline. There was the other one, Freaky, which was a body swap twist on a slasher type film. And It's a Wonderful Knife is if a slasher film was the basis for It's a Wonderful Life. And you don't see too many It's a Wonderful Life homages anymore on TV. And there was a period of time where every TV show did an It's a Wonderful Life thing, you know, the kid where you wish you weren't born and you see how bad things were. And sometimes it's brilliant, like in Married with Children, when they did that, Ted discovered that everyone's life was better. And so he's like, well, I don't want to do that. So he went back and said, no, I want everyone to be as miserable as I am. So he goes back and regains his life. So there's parts of this that really, really work. And even though the killer dresses up like Moon Knight for some reason, it's an effective serial killer type movie. But it seems weirdly rushed. Because the whole thing is it has this part 1 year where the serial killer attacks and the girl kills him. And then you have to get to the next year and she realizes that there's still problems and that people aren't dealing with it properly. And she makes her wish and then you have to go back. So it almost feels like there's almost three movies and they just kind of burn through them at like 15-minute intervals. And so there's a real pacing issue. And I don't know what you could have done about it because you either have to be multiple movies or it have to be like a series. I guess if you made it a series, but then that's a whole nother monster. That's, I guess, forgivable for what it is. And I mean, I like the characters. I mean, some of them get in the way. And at times they try too hard to not be a cliche, even though you're working in cliche. That's the whole point. But it works for a movie. It's funny. I mean, Justin Long plays the mayor of the city, who's basically the Potter character from It's a Wonderful Life. And he does his best job channeling Walton Goggins' Uncle Baby Billy character from The Righteous Gemstones. And there's some people who are just kind of weirdly placed. Like Joel McHale is oddly cast as the girl's dad. But overall, it's, you know, for somebody who loves the horror genre, somebody who loves slashers, to see an It's a Wonderful Life version of a slasher is kind of fun. I mean, it's a nice little holiday spirit. You know, even though it feels rushed, it plays with convention and cliche enough to keep things fresh for a slasher movie in the holidays. You know, happy holidays, ho, 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 stab, stab, stab. We've had plenty of horror movies for holidays. The Santa Claus being the killer and, yeah, hey, why not have Moon Knight running around in an It's a Wonderful Life homage? I'm going to say this one kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about The Marvels and Journey to Bethlehem. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about The Marvels. It's about Captain Marvel, Ms. Marvel, and Monica Rambeau, soon to be Marvel named. Anyways, after their powers get entangled, three superheroes join together to fight a galactic threat.
Hi.
We're looking for Kamala Khan.
Dang it!
Okay, so our powers are entangled.
I can manipulate light energy. And you,
I can totally show you.
No!
Again!
Hi.
Where's our daughter?
Wherever you were.
We're a team?
Oh, no, we're not a team.
We're not a team.
Captain Marvel did insanely well, like unprecedentedly well. But I think part of the reason that did so well is it came out between Infinity War and Endgame. And it got the bump that, like, say, Iron Man 3 got, being the first Marvel movie to come out after the Avengers. And to think that the Marvels is going to do exactly what Captain Marvel did is foolish. But there's some other asterisks to it. They really couldn't promote this one. They had like 12 hours from when the strike ended to when the movie started showing up in theaters. So, I mean, like, Kevin Feige was probably banging on Brie Larson's door saying, come on, we got to go. We got to get this done. So that's always going to be a struggle for it, just in order to get it heard about and seen. But there's also this contingent out there of people who just hate Brie Larson. And I think that's stupid. Brie Larson's fine. I've actually interviewed her. She's sweet. She seems really cool. The thing with this movie is Captain Marvel was very serious and at least had seriousness with the character, because Carol Danvers is kind of this no-nonsense character. And what really makes this movie work is pairing her up with Iman Vellani and Teyana Paris as Kamala Khan and Monica Rambeau. And honestly, it's Iman Vellani who steals the show. Now, I don't know if you watched Ms. Marvel. I really enjoyed Ms. Marvel mainly because of her. I thought she had this really good mix of childlike awe and fangirl excitement and sincerity. And then the character of Monica Rambeau, she was really only in WandaVision. Now, I'll tell you one of the things. You do not have to go watch all these shows. You don't have to watch 6 hours of WandaVision and 6 hours of Ms. Marvel and then watch 2.5 hours of Captain Marvel. They explain enough of what goes on. I mean, yeah, it's kind of crazy and silly, but if they say, okay, we all have light powers and we can do this, just accept it. Don't start they didn't explain where that came from. It's like, yeah, if you just accept it, it's a science fiction. It's a comic book movie. It's a comic book movie. Come on. So when anyone complains, it doesn't seem realistic. 4 words. It's a comic book. Duh. I was talking to somebody who saw it, and they brought up some plot point, and I'm like, yeah, okay, yeah, that maybe didn't make a whole lot of sense, but when she was flying through space, what was blowing in her hair? Oh, I guess nothing, because space doesn't have wind, because it's space. But honestly, this movie was kind of a delight. It really was a lot of fun. It has the excitement, and it has the banter. The lightheartedness that made the first early Avengers films work is present in this movie. And it's not necessarily Brie Larson who does it, because she still plays that somewhat no-nonsense character. But the three of them together work. They really have chemistry, and they're these points on a triangle that balance really, really well. And the action really works as the three of them, as they're sort of zapping around, and what happens is their powers get entangled, and when they use them, they swap places. And that plays into comedy, it plays into action, it plays into them having to start to work together as a team. This was a lot of fun. It really felt like an early Avengers movie. And it has great action, it has great effects. I mean, yeah, if you're tired of superhero movies, you're going to get annoyed with this. But, you know, for the rest of us, it's a good time. It's not meant to rework the universe. That's the thing. You go back to the original Iron Man. Iron Man set the stage for all the Avengers movies. But it didn't feel like that's what Iron Man was trying to do. And this one doesn't feel like it's trying to set up all these other things that are happening in the future. It looks like it's trying to tell a relatively pointed story about them trying to stop this genocidal alien. There's a lot of genocidal aliens around. So yeah, I mean, this is surprisingly fun and full of energy, and this Marvel film blends three different characters into a great new team. I really enjoyed it. I'm going to say that the Marvels totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Journey to Bethlehem. I wonder what this one's about. This musical version of the lead up to Christ's birth blends whimsy with scripture.
Harry, you're getting married. It's about to be the best day of your life.
I'm Joseph. I feel like we're already friends, no?
Harry, God has chosen you to have a son. The King of all kings.
This wasn't a dream. An angel came to me.
It's hard to have faith
It's hard to believe.
Look at the star. The future
holds more. This is it.
Let's go.
Okay, I got to tell you this. This is just so funny to me. I got a screener for this, and it came with one of these, like, sort of embargo letters. And I was reading it, and it's like, don't give away any spoilers. And I'm like, it's based on the Bible. I mean, like, one of the most widely read books on the planet. And of that book, it's the part that's even most widely read of the most widely read book. Christ is born at the end. I hate to tell you people, that's how the movie ends. It ends with the birth of Christ. That's what it's about. They go to Bethlehem, and I mean, does that spoil it from anybody? It's like Titanic, the boat sinks. We all know that. Anyways, I was tickled by that. But I didn't know what to think about this until I watched it, because I've always been very iffy with some of these faith-based movies, and it's not about the content, really. It's about the quality of filmmaking. I've seen a lot of faith-based movies that are not well directed, written, or edited, or acted. And that's a shame, because, I mean, there's some very worthwhile stories in these things. But this one actually, it strangely works, because you hear and you say, oh, they're going to do a musical version, like a musical theater version of the nativity story. And reflexively start to roll your eyes at that. But I started watching it, and I'm like, you know, this isn't bad. It gets cheeky at times. Like Antonio Banderas plays Herod, which is an odd choice. But he just completely chews the scenery. And that's fine. That's kind of, he has fun with it. But it has some actually pretty catchy songs. They're not great. Some of them are better than others. But, it works. Now, I mean, there are some elements that are, people can pick things apart about, how accurate it is to the scripture. It tries to be as accurate as it can be to the scripture, but also kind of give it a modern feel to it. And like there's a whole thing where Mary is not happy about just being told that she has to marry. And then when it comes to the whole thing where she ends up pregnant, she's like, this was not the normal way. And no one believes her. She gets very adamant about certain things. And she kind of takes this very modern, almost feminist approach of, well, I have to want to consent to this marriage. And I don't think that's historically accurate, but it's okay. That's fine. You've been doing that. Like I said, they've been doing that in Disney movies. So if you're out there complaining that Rachel Zegler is talking about modernizing Snow White, and you're also not attacking this girl for wanting to modernize how people got married in Judea 2,000 years ago, then you're a hypocrite. They're trying to make this accessible to today, and I think that we can ignore some historical precedents for that. I was surprised. It was a fun little movie. It was cute. It sometimes leans a little bit too much into the humor, but I would rather have that than have it be like overly serious. Like there's a whole scene where the angel Gabriel is going to come down and tell Mary that she's going to be pregnant, and it's him rehearsing before he does it, and he's kind of full of anxiety. And I'm like, okay, that's kind of clever. I don't know if the angel Gabriel is going to be like, I'm nervous. So it has some cute stuff. Kind of surprised, sometimes a bit corny. But this modern look at the nativity is going to be a crowd pleaser for sure. I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, we're going to switch gears and talk about Bloody Bridget. And then do the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Insidious, The Red Door. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Karn. Let's continue on with the movie reviews. I'm doing a special one this time. Kind of fell into my lap. It actually does not have distribution, and it's rare for me to do one that doesn't have distribution. But this one caught my eye. I was very curious about this one. And that is a movie called Bloody Bridget. It's directed by Richard Elfman, who was one of the founders of Oingo Boingo with his brother Danny. And He's done a lot of things, everything from journalism to music to filmmaking. And after watching a movie like this, I'm like, I want to go party with this guy because he seems bonkers. And I really don't have a trailer for it because he sent me the press kit And there's a trailer, but it's just imagery with music to it. So it you're not going to get any sort of feeling of plot or character to it. But I encourage you to go search for this online, and you can watch the trailer yourself and say, yeah, that thing's going to be bonkers. Anyways, in Bloody Bridget, Maverick filmmaker Richard Elfman directs this bonkers story about a burlesque dancer turned voodoo vampire who goes on a murderous rampage of justice. From the moment the movie started, it looks like it's like charcoal-based artwork. And it's different scenes from a background to the characters of the movie. And then it starts into a burlesque show where they're doing like a horror burlesque at a seedy nightclub in Van Nuys. And it stars Anastasia Elfman, who's Richard's wife. And she plays this woman who's just trying to, I mean, she's this bohemian who's trying to do a performance and doing these gigs. And it's very over the top, and it's very vibrant and very colorful. And one of the things I do love about this movie is the look of it. It is vibrant. It's colorful. There's a lot of brightness to it. There's a lot of darkness to it too, but it doesn't look like you're looking through a murky fish tank like so many movies I've seen lately. It has bold choices of colors. It's well lit. And it's crisp, and it does use some digital effects. It has these digital backgrounds, but it's a low budget film, and it's okay if you can see that sort of thing. But the story is basically, she is this descendant, or not a descendant, but she's a reincarnation of Saint Bridget, which had come over from Ireland to marry a voodoo priest in Haiti, and he's basically coming to reclaim her. And so she turns into a vampire because she goes and she has sex with him in the spiritual realm and comes back as a vampire and discovers she has a bloodlust. And so she goes and decides to start killing bad people. She's killing murderers and rapists and wife abusers. And maybe some of the people, like there's a car thief and she kills a car thief. I'm like, I don't know if we need to have the death penalty for car thieves, but okay. But it's or purse snatching. But there's a guy in a hockey mask who's trying to kill somebody with a knife, and so she kills him. And I mean, it is insane and over. I mean, it is out there. It is a weird, weird movie, but it also has an insane amount of energy to it. It really does feel. I mean, I don't know a whole lot about Richard Elfman and his history, but. I do know, like I said, he's a founding member of Oingo Boingo. And back when it was like the Mystic Knights of the Oingo Boingo, before it became sort of new wave band of the 80s, it was sort of a traveling show. It's sort of this all-inclusive. It's not just music, but it's theater and it's dance and all this kind of stuff. And that makes sense when you watch this movie. It is bizarre and strange. And it has this imagery, but it also has a real tongue firmly in cheek. I mean, just some of the characters are just so bizarre and strange. And I can't even explain who some of the characters are. Like these lawyers that she gets to try to get out of this contract with the devil she has. They're dwarf lawyers that are Jewish. Now, for that matter, Richard Elfman's Jewish too. So that's why it's okay. But their names are Daniel, and it's like, Better Dial Daniel is the name of the law firm, which is a total ripoff of Better Call Saul. Not a ripoff, but a homage to it. And that's the kind of weird tongue-in-cheek humor. It doesn't overexplain itself. But, you know, then they have this whole thing where they have the Jewish lawyers arguing against Satan, and they got a Catholic priest with them because they got the voodoo angle. It is completely out there and bizarre, but it also has a lot of humor to it. And its tongue's completely in its cheek, sometimes out of its cheek, sometimes completely out of somebody's head. But it's very violent and gory, but it's meant to be, it's almost like kitsch or camp. You know, I mean, it has the energy of like Rocky Horror. And that's what I really enjoyed about it. And it is just strange, but amazingly compelling. You can't kind of take your eyes off it. I mean, it's like, you know, it plays like the Mighty Boosh shot a feminist voodoo vampire version of Dexter in the Full Moon Studios in the 1990s. And I'm all in for it. I mean, this thing is bonkers and it's insane. it's definitely R-rated. But I had a blast watching. Apparently, he's going around and doing this in film festivals or around the world, really, but a lot of them around the country. And they have, like, music and shows and barbecue. I mean, it's just an insane amount of stuff that's happening on these shows. I don't know how this guy does it because he's older than me, and I barely had the energy to watch the movie. So, but, I mean, this is a fun film. Bloody Bridget, I enjoyed it. There's going to be a Bloody Bridget 2, apparently. So, yeah, I'm all in. Totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight is on Insidious, The Red Door. The reason I'm going after this one is it finally hit Netflix. It came out at the beginning of July, and I was on vacation. I had taken an Alaskan cruise with my wife. It was our anniversary, so I had deserved some time off. And so I missed that week. I had a bye week, just somewhere in the middle of July. And I didn't get a chance to cover it. I liked the Insidious series, so I said, oh, it's showing up on Netflix, so let's take a chance to watch it. This latest Insidious film follows Josh and Dalton Lambert as they begin to remember the trauma of their past.
When I was 10, I was in a coma. But I don't even remember being sick. I'm seeing crazy stuff. I think these drawings could be clues from my past.
There's so much you don't know. And I was too scared to tell you the truth.
Our family has been keeping secrets. They suppressed our memories. But I can still feel something following us.
There's only one way to find out.
This is directed by Patrick Wilson, who starred in all the other Insidious movies. He also stars as Ed Warren in the Conjuring films. And I love Wilson's connection to horror films. I love the fact that he's game to do these. Because he's a big star. I mean, he's in the Aquaman movies. But he still does the horror films. And I like that he's completely willing to do it. And there's elements in this movie that make you remember the earlier films. But I really believe that the Insidious films have kind of steadily gone down. The first one I thought was brilliant, with its use of sound and silence and imagery and background stuff and sort of these subliminal elements and the use of practical shots in that movie. The Insidious 2 I thought was really interesting because there were some bold choices made by James Wan to direct scary scenes in very, very bright light. And that's not easy to do. And I don't know if he completely achieved it, but I respected his attempt. The third Insidious movie I thought was, The Last Key? I didn't think that one was that good. And this one's, it's a little bit better because it feels like it's a little more grounded in the original characters. I love the fact that they go back to resolving this story between the father and son, where the son went into a coma because he astral projected into the further and was kidnapped by a demon. I mean, I thought that was really neat. And so you see these throwbacks to that movie, but the pacing isn't great. And I think part of it is just, it just feels like Patrick Wilson needs a little more seasoning as a director to really make it work. Whereas like somebody like James Wan is really a master at putting together a movie. And some of his films aren't great, but some of his stuff's really, really good, especially his horror stuff. And this is a good first effort, you know, so I would love to see Patrick Wilson do more. But I think he holds the movie back a little bit just as a director. And then also, you know, they're working off of a story that's like, I don't know, what, 4 or 5 movies deep into this whole Insidious franchise. I mean, the setup was great, but the Insidious series has lost a lot of luster. I didn't love this movie. It loses focus and it turns into a bunch of jump scares at times. So I got to say, it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
And that's it for the show. I need to go. Next week, I'm going to be talking about The Hunger Games, The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, and Trolls Band Together. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.